Welcome to the Food and Farming Podcast from AHDB, keeping levy payers informed and at the heart of the conversation.
Hi, I'm Laura Audrey, one of the Knowledge Exchange Managers for the dairy sector at AHDB. And this episode is the second and final part of an interview with plant and soil health expert Joel Williams. Joel is a much sought-after speaker and recently toured England and Scotland as part of a series of meetings organised by AHDB. My colleague Anna Reynolds, who's Head of Engagement for Cereals and Oilseeds, had the driving responsibilities and ferried Joel up and down the country. We recorded Joel's thoughts after the Devon meeting on a range of subjects, grabbing the opportunity when we could, whether it was in the farm shop or, as the hours rolled on and conversation flowed, we had to take it out and finish recording in the car. In part one, we covered systems approaches, measurement of soil and plant health and nutrition. So if you missed that, don't forget to catch up. As for this episode, we'll be tackling topics like productivity versus profitability, future research areas for AHDB and diversity. In fact, that's where we pick up the conversation, with Joel giving us his thoughts on integrated pest management.
You know, I'm very interested in some of these alternative strategies to manage pest and disease, like optimizing plant nutrition, like the role of the soil microbiome and beneficial microbes in order to also suppress those pests and diseases. And I think if we kind of look into the literature on this, there's actually a lot of really good and well-studied, well-researched examples of how there's specific nutrients are needed for the plant to increase its cell wall strength, increase kind of build structural barriers, to kind of thicken up the skin or thicken up the primary defenses of the plant to keep out the pest and disease from getting through that thick skin. And so if you look into the literature, there's actually a lot of really good studies that show that nutritionally deficient plants have weakened immune systems, that they're not able to build those barriers, or they're not able to build other defense chemicals, internal systemic chemicals that can also have suppressive effects, be distasteful to insects, or suppress pathogens and this type of thing. So the plant has uses those nutrients to fuel these defense systems. And this is actually very well studied in the literature. I think that really much more of the barrier is the practical application of that, how we kind of translate that out into the field in a practical and meaningful way. That farmers can kind of optimize that nutrition and therefore plant health. And similarly with the biology, all those beneficial microbes, they can also have suppressive effects. They can, as beneficial microbes grow, they excrete all sorts of antibiotic and antifungal type substances, and they can also have these suppressive effects. So both of these strategies, I think, are very useful and both really relevant. But I acknowledge we have some knowledge gaps. There's some practical application gaps. So therefore, I look at these as tools of great potential, but somewhat imperfect. And I think that that's when you're combining imperfect tools like that, and actually that can be then a great strength, is if you like any integrated approach, integrated nutrient management, integrated pest management, the point of it is to integrate many strategies, because some of them are imperfect and some of them may work better or worse in different contexts and conditions. So therefore we integrate many tools in the toolbox, we apply many strategies with an overall goal of helping with the pest in this example. So I think that when we talk about nutrition, there's great potential, and we talk about microbiology, there's great potential, but yes, they are a little imperfect. So in order to help kind of overcome some of that imperfection, we also then have to have this conversation about diversity, plant species diversity, and how by just having a little bit more diversity in the production systems amongst the plant community, this actually creates barriers and creates an environment, a condition, which is not so conducive to pest and insect spread. That's the kind of the design flaw of the monoculture, is that if that plant and if that variety is susceptible, then every plant in that field is susceptible. So if a pest or disease moves in, they can spread like wildfire very quickly. But as soon as we have more plant species diversity, meaning we have now a mixture of plants, some non-hosts, some hosts, some susceptible, some not, we have this kind of gradient, this tapestry, this mixture there of plants that can ultimately help to create barriers and help ultimately dilute the susceptible plant hosts, in which then can then help to slow the spread of that pathogen or that disease. So that's really the essence of what using diversity for integrated pest management is for. It's kind of about diluting hosts, blending together, having physical barriers to kind of stop the spread and confuse the insect and make it harder for the pathogen to spread. And I think that is really relevant, because then when we try and layer on and integrate those additional tools like the nutrition, like the microbiology, biofertilizers that I know some farmers are playing around with, I think you're giving those two imperfect strategies a much better leg up, giving them a much better chance of success when you're putting them in an environment that is plant species wise much more diverse and therefore much less conducive to rapid spread of the pest or disease. So you're ultimately giving those two tools a better fighting chance of actually providing more benefit and suppressive quality. So I think that how we redesign farming, how we redesign especially crop production, but also even in a pasture context, having these multi-species pastures, all of these kind of this greater diversity, it helps to create this environment that is less conducive so that those other strategies can then be more effective.
At some of the meetings, there were audience concerns, obviously, about seeing diversity actually as a threat, potential negative effects, such as, cover crops increasing weed pressures in the rotation or slug burdens. And I guess from possibly a livestock perspective, farmers who have quite a successful monocrop relying on heavy nitrogen inputs will see the cost benefit that system. So adding diversity and changing that, how would you approach that for farmers that do view that as a threat to the business?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think a lot of people talk about diversity and the benefits of diversity, but diversity can very much be a collaborative thing, but it can also be a competitive thing. And I acknowledge that there's some specifics there and context there that's important. And that might be things like this, the seeding rates, the plant population density, the varieties. Some things there, interactions there then may be negative and have a competitive effect, competing for soil moisture, competing for nutrients. There could be some negatives there to that. So it's not to say that diversity is always by default a complementary and positive thing. And yeah, so I think the examples you gave are great ones. Cover crops, if they go to seed, they could potentially be increasing weed burden. They can make weed management and some of our kind of herbicide programs more complex to manage. There can be great challenges associated with that. So there is that risk of weed and slugs would be, of course, a good example that you also raise. So that's a real challenge. And I think on the livestock phase, multi-species pastures are all the rage these days, and I think rightly so. They have a lot of really benefits to them, but sure, some of those other varieties or species that can go in there, they might have great soil health improving benefit, but they may not be the best in terms of digestibility or quality feed. So bringing in some of those other diverse species can actually a little bit reduce the quality of the food. So all of those are great examples of where maybe that diversity is not by default always a good thing, and it's not always that more is better. There's going to be a line there about how we how many we use, and I acknowledge that there are some knowledge gaps in this space in terms of which are the blends that are very complementary, which are the varieties that are less prone to going to seed as a weed, which in the pasture context, what is the percentage of those maybe slightly lower quality forage? What's the maximum we can have in there to get some benefit from them, but without it starting to really dominate the overall forage kind of ration diet of the animal? So is there a percentage of seeding rate that just puts a bit of those in there without compromising the quality of the feed? So I acknowledge that, again, it's a kind of a bit of a practical challenge of these. It's, I think the evidence base is very sound to these principles and how diversity can help. But I think, there's maybe just a few practical kind of hurdles and nuances that we need to fine tune. And I think that the my answer to there is, because there's a lot of local specifics and contexts that sit under that. So that's, I think, a good example of the importance of farmer to farmer meetings, peer to peer learning, is talking to other farmers in your area and learning what's working for them, getting recommendations, learning from others, and using that as the foundation and then steering your choices of that diversity or species and rates and all that kind of thing. You can fine-tune the variables from there, but I would start with the importance of kind of local knowledge, peer-to-peer learning, I think is really key.
Well, we did actually have another question from a farmer. Peter Mawson had gotten in touch with us through Twitter, and he had some specific questions wondering how to alleviate compaction on clay soils in permanent pastures. Would you be able to give any insight into that, Joel?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. There's going to be many local specific things here, but I think that, I would say that it's going to be, again, multiple pieces of the puzzle here are going to help. And it may be that some more intensive kind of drainage system is going to really help. Some of those heavy clay soils just do not drain very well. So having kind of actual physical drainage in place to kind of help speed up that could be a part of that process at that kind of more macro level. It could be things like the calcium content of the soil. They might want to look at their calcium content. Calcium helps to flocculate soil particles, which means open them up, improve the structure. So calcium is renowned to improve the structural properties of soil. So I would consider maybe looking at calcium as a nutrient, and that might be some lime or gypsum or something that they might need to apply to help chemically kind of open up that soil. But then it's also about roots. You know, it's about those deep-rooted plant species. You really need them to then get down into that soil to create the channels and the tunnels so that the water will actually infiltrate, get in, and then also percolate out down the bottom of that soil. So it's not going to be, let's be honest, I think we all know some of those heavy clay soils, they're going to take time to turn around. It's not going to happen overnight. But I think you kind of need some of those macro kind of structural level drainage, maybe at the field level, some calcium, and then really about choosing the right plant species with deep roots to kind of open that up and keep that open. But key to that is then also grazing management. So for those pastures to achieve deep roots, it takes time to grow deep roots. So, and that often means giving them nice long rest and recovery periods, not kind of grazing too tight too frequently, because that's going to have a more suppressive effect on root depth and rooting activity. So definitely kind of some of those, you know, tall grass mob grazing type strategies to get higher grass, higher pastures, which will also give us deeper roots. And I know that's harder for some of the dairy farmers to do in terms of the drop in forage quality there, but, there may be scope for them to, in that context anyway, put a field aside to give it that full expression of those kind of diverse and full expression pastures, to take it out of the intensive dairy cycle for a while, give it that restoration process, a nice long recovery, and then bring it back in after it's harvested. You could kind of cut and remove that and then bring that field back into the more intensive rotation, but you've kind of tried to do some restructuring and restorative work with those taller plants. So those are some of the things I would try to look at, but I know that's a tricky question. There's no easy answer to that one.
You mentioned some deep rooting plants and sort of that anti-compaction potential of plants. Do you have any particular plants in mind for that, or maybe sowing times or any practical tips?
We fall back a little bit onto the generic answer of a bit of diversity there, because it's like different plants will do different things in different ways. So I would try to consider a few, but of course some of the favorite ones are, you know, your classic kind of chicory and plantain. They're good for the tap rooting, but then you also want some more deeper fibrous roots, and I think things like timothy or coxfoot on the grasses are really good, and even lucerne. You know, I think lucerne is perhaps an underutilized plant. It has a fantastic deep root system, plus it's a great legume, great protein forage. So yeah, I would kind of consider, I think, a bit of a diversity of some of those particularly of interest. Sowing times and things is a tricky one. I think farmers have got to manage that in their own context, but generally I think the autumn time is a bit better to do that establishment, so that you can, they're really there, ready to go, ready to kind of spring into action in spring.
And if we're incorporating livestock into an arable rotation, perhaps only looking at a short-term lay, do these same plants that they still have potential to do a really good job in that sort of relatively short period of time.
I think having, if you can fit a two-year a perennial phase in an arable rotation, I think that's still enough time for some of those benefits for sure. Year one is a little, you know, it's kind of a little bit more of their establishment phase. They're not going to be super restructuring and some of the, get those kind of key benefits in year one, but you're basically setting it up for then year two to achieve that. And many farmers would know that with something like clover, it's kind of in year one, it does okay, but then it does much better in year two and three. So I think that it is 2 years is a minimum for that kind of a, to really get some better benefits. I think if you could push, if a farmer could push it to 3 years, it'd be better. But I think 2 years is a minimum. But yeah, I do think that even in that window, you can see some of the benefits. But again, I would still be integrating that with probably some other more annual type plant species who are also very fast growing and can also kind of start some of that change very quickly. And then the perennials can kind of carry on into year two and three kind of thing. So I would still use a bit of a diversity of annuals and perennials.
Brilliant. So it's basically sounds like you very much need to tailor your mix to whether you're doing a winter cover, you're doing winter all the way through to the next autumn, or you're doing 1 year, 2 years. And it's very much dependent on that length of time as to what species are going to perform best.
Yeah, that's right. And that's, again, kind of a little bit part of that kind of that strategy about diversity, is that if you are using a mixture of some more cooler thriving species, some more warmer, some annual, some perennial, some deeper rooted, some maybe more shallow, that's, again, part of that strategy of trying to hedge your bets and get benefits from all sorts of those different plant families. So, choosing a mixture of kind of warm and cool season can kind of give you plants that will be more photosynthetically active or more adapt to growing at those range of kind of different conditions throughout the year. And that's, again, along that same analogy, is kind of one of the benefits of, say, the diverse cover crops, cocktail cover crops. You know, you could sow the exact same mix in two different years, and which one might be hotter or cooler or wetter or drier. You know, you never know what environmental conditions are coming, and that's kind of the benefit of that point about diversity of hedging your bets, is that you could plant the same mix and what ends up kind of dominating or being, you know, more active in each of those 2 years could be completely different. And that's part of the strength of the diversity. It brings that resilience so that no matter what conditions come and unfold, which we can never know, you'll at least always have something there that will provide, will fill that niche and be functional and photosynthesize more so.
And talking of things thriving and benefiting, I think we've had a lot of questions, haven't we, Laura, about weeds in the rotation and in the fields, and specifically what it is that they're telling you and showing you about your soil health and perhaps nutrient deficits or excess in the soil.
Yeah, that's a tricky question to answer, because I think it's very specific to that weed. So we'd probably be here for another hour or more unpacking each and every one. And I'll be honest, I don't know each and every one myself anyway. But I think that stepping back from that, I really support that idea of, you know, weeds as indicators, and that they can help signpost our management in terms of identifying what issues are there. And, you know, there are some specific ones that you could kind of dive into, and others some more kind of general ones. But I agree with the premise of weeds as indicators. I think you've got to take it a little bit with a grain of salt at times. I think it's a useful guide like, for example, you know, if the weed has a lot of, is a very tap-rooting plant, for example, like everybody's favorite docks, for example, you know, then that's perhaps there the indication that the soils are very tight and compacted, and therefore that's why we're growing those deeper tap-rooted plants, to try and correct that. So, like, I think there's some of those kind of basic ideas of weed indicators, which I think are really valid, and I think... But I think sometimes, yeah, some of those kind of rules can be a bit generalized, and there can be some kind of specific context where maybe it doesn't but always add up so explicitly. But the general idea, I think, makes sense. Of course, things grow where they're adapted to. And the true is the same of weeds. So I think that in terms of practically managing that, it's really about looking at those weeds as in two different ways. One, to say, okay, what is the function of this weed? And let's use the taproot example as another one there. So can I replace this weed with another plant that has more agricultural function and benefit that performs that same function? So could we try and plant other taprooted plants like chicory or plantain, you know, for example, who will have a similarly nice deep taproot like the docks would. So you're really trying to choose another plant to provide that the same function that the weed is providing. So that's kind of one way. Or you could look at it through species and say, well, what is the species of that weed plant? And is there a closely related agricultural species that I could then maybe try and plant there? And maybe it could, you know, provide that same benefit that the weed is trying to benefit, but do it in a way that's more agriculturally useful for us.
Now, some of the other questions, the multitude of questions we've had, one actually came in asking about saving seeds and potentially by saving your own seed, you know, does this negate any sort of impact of genetic loss of varieties? You know, what are the role of epigenetics and disease resistance over time? And what were your sort of thoughts on this, Joel?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a topic of great interest of mine. It's I've got a few really good papers on this that I've scanned through, and it's a topic that I am planning on doing a lot more future work in, bringing together some kind of conglomerating some of that research and putting that into some presentations. I'm a big fan of seed saving, and it's really just the simple idea that when plants grow and they grow and complete their life cycle, the environment in which they're growing sends them all sorts of triggers and cues. The plants respond to that. They switch on certain genes depending on those environmental triggers and cues. And as they go through that development of that life cycle and then produce seed and mature that seed, the genes that kind of the plant needed to turn on, that it used from those environmental triggers and cues, those kind of genes get upregulated in that next generation in that seed. The seed has the instructions to say, okay, these are the genes that I needed when I was producing you in that life cycle, and this is kind of really a little bit about, you mentioned epigenetics there. That's really talking about where we can change, we're not changing the genetic makeup of the plant, but we are changing the expression of those genes or the way they behave and function. So the overall genetic makeup is the same, but just the behavior and function differs. And that can be some of these what's called epigenetic factors, many of these kind of environmental triggers that tack on to genes and kind of then change their activity or their behavior, so to speak. And so that's the benefit of seed saving, is that you are fine-tuning the genetics of that plant, of that species, of that variety. You are fine-tuning those genetics to say, okay, here's how you need to survive and thrive in this microenvironment, and you can pass that information on to the next generation. And that's really what that is. And of course, the opposite is a big problem, where if we buy in seed that's been grown in a completely different soil type, in a completely different environment, maybe even a completely different country, and we bring that seed then onto our farm, well, that seed has been tuned to the previous environment and the soil conditions in which it came from. And, you know, particularly this interest around the soil microbiome, the way in which those microbes of the soil interact with that plant, they are sending a lot of these triggers and cues that can kind of change this genetic expression of the plant. So the point about seed saving is that then that plant gets adapted to your soil microbiome, to your environmental conditions, and that information is kind of ultimately sent through into the next generation to kind of fine tune that process. So that's why, yeah, I'm a really big fan of seed saving. And that can really help. It's really just about fine-tuning the genetics that are already there in that variety, just fine-tuning them to your local context, your local climate, and adapting them to suit that. And I think that's there's a lot of benefits to doing that as compared to buying in fresh seed each time, each year kind of thing.
Have you seen some example of this working and being able to actually sort of see the benefit somehow, or measure the benefit, or?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's also gets a little tricky, and this is not an area of high priority research, I guess. But I think that practically speaking, how some farmers are using this idea is through things like, yes, seed saving. And then we talked a bit earlier about sort of biofertilizers and some of the microbial additives. You know, one of the more simpler, cheaper, easy ways to kind of add biology back into the system is through something like a compost extract, where you're just taking compost, mixing it with water, extracting out those organisms. And then the most common, one of the more common ways to use that liquid in this context is kind of as a seed treatment or inject into the furrow. And really what that's then trying to do is merge these two ideas of saying, okay, here's the genetics of the plant, and I'm going to put a really diverse biological inoculum around that seed of those organisms so that when that seed grows, you've got all of these benefits of the microbes from that compost extract and some of their various biochemicals that they also produce, which can then support and trigger this kind of unique expression of the plant genetics as it goes on. So practically speaking, that's kind of one of the ways in which farmers are doing this and trying to combine that seed saving practice with a heightened kind of soil biological inoculum to kind of really increase the kind of the expression there of the plant. So, but yeah, of course, it's something that's very difficult to quantify. It's not necessarily something that drives yield, but it's perhaps more of that point about resilience in terms of the overall system of the overall performance of the system, helping those plants really be more adapt, be more pest and disease resistant, these types of things that aren't maybe necessarily always so directly observable.
And is that something you've seen play out in practice? So perhaps somebody's been able to reduce some other input, or the resilience meant that it's the plants have done better than they might otherwise have done in difficult conditions?
So of course, this is a great question. This comes back to our early discussion of holistic management, systems thinking versus reductionist. And so farmers who are playing around with these ideas, of course, that's not the only thing that they're playing around with. They're also integrating many other tools and strategies. So how much of the legwork is coming from this idea? How big is the contribution of seed saving in this kind of discussion? This is the negative of the holistic approach, is that because it's looking more holistically and it's just trying all of these various pieces of the puzzle, the negative, you could argue, of that is that we don't know which of those pieces is doing the bulk of the work or the big of the legwork. And so many would view that as a real negative of the holistic approach, which is absolutely fine and fair comment. But equally, when you are managing at that systems level, that's also the point of the other side of that coin. That's the benefit, is that, well, although I don't know, but as a system overall, if, as long as the system is performing and functioning, then it doesn't necessarily matter. So yes, you know, there are farmers who are, as you would be aware, there's a lot of experimentation happening, especially here in the UK, of farmers trying to reduce fungicide inputs, substitute with biologicals or nutrition, and doing foliars and all of these types of things. And of course, like always, there's some really great examples of this working out there, some great case study examples of it working, and other times it's not working. You know, it's not a perfect tool, and that's really then the point of integrating many tools and taking that more systems approach, is that overall, as long as the outcomes are moving in the right direction, although we may not know how each and every piece is performing, we take that systems approach toward the greater kind of direction. So, yeah, that's a great question. It really brings up kind of the pros and the cons of those two approaches. And no, I think it's still quite an emerging idea in practice. I mean, there are some very interesting studies that have looked at this whole point about genetic expression and how the next generation might carry on traits. And yes, we do have very good papers that you know, are controlling more of those variables to determine that this effect happens. This effect is called transgenerational traits, where things that happen to the mother plant, that information is ultimately stored in the seed and remember. So, for example, there's very good examples of studies that, again, have demonstrated this in principle, but again, it's part of the practical challenges that we're talking about earlier. But we have good examples where if the mother plant is exposed to a pathogen and that triggers an immune response in that plant, that immune response that gets triggered ultimately gets carried through into the seed, and that the next generation is resistant to that pathogen because of that exposure of the mother plant. So we have specific examples of that being demonstrated, but that resistance that gets carried to the next generation, just in this particular example that I can think of, it only lasted one generation. So it was the next generation that had that resistance. If that second generation then was not then again exposed to that pathogen, then the third one wouldn't have it at all. So it was lost after one. So yes, it's a sound principle. We have like really good studies that demonstrate mechanisms and how this is working. But you put that into a farm and an agricultural setting where there's then many, many variables at play here. It becomes very difficult to boil it down, to reduce it down, to say what exactly is and how much is that benefit. It's been very hard to answer, and that's, again, the strength and the weakness of those two approaches.
I'm Laura Audrey, and you're listening to AHDB's Food and Farming Podcast, featuring plant and soil health expert Joel Williams. Joel was over recently for a series of meetings organised by AHDB. My colleague Anna Reynolds had the task of making sure she got him to each and every one of the 7 events across England and Scotland, but we made sure we took some time out to record Joel's thoughts after the meeting in Devon. In this episode, we've already heard Joel chat about diversity as a defence and a threat. He also talked to us about productivity versus profitability.
We talk about what is the economic outcome of improving my soil health, or what is the economic benefit to doing some of these practices or to this holistic approach. And again, it's very difficult to kind of directly link these things to a financial outcome, which of course is something that many farmers are always interested in. But again, if we step back from that, there are very obvious, you know, indirect benefits in which we can overall help the system performance and therefore improve the profitability. And, you know, we can break that down very simply into many different kind of contexts. So if the soil's better physically structured, it's going to have better nutrients, biological activity, better nutrient supply, and plants will benefit from that. Therefore, we are, as we were talking about earlier, leveraging the fertility that's already there in soils by optimizing soil health. We're going to improve nutrient cycling, and therefore that opens up the opportunity to financially be rewarded through less input costs, through input savings. And so I think this is the point about the economic benefits of some of these more less kind of tangible direct, these are the kind of less tangible things, is that when they are added, when they come together and when they add up for the overall performance of the system, there are economic gains in terms of, for example, better leveraging of soil fertility, more savings on fertilizer inputs. And I think that's where really the profitability can come in this kind of debate about, well, is soil health really going to increase yield? Or if I've got more earthworms, I'm doing all this stuff and I'm increasing my earthworm counts, how does that affect my yield? How does that affect my, you know, therefore my profitability? And it's hard because, of course, it's all great to have more earthworms in that spade full of soil, but earthworms don't pay the bills.
No, they don't. And I think a lot of our listeners will be thinking, some of our listeners will definitely be thinking this and asking, it all sounds quite difficult potentially. You know, there's a lot of learning to be done in systems thinking, and there's a lot of stuff to know, and potentially sounds expensive, because it sounds like there's a lot of things that we can buy now that are very different, have different functions. And perhaps these things don't, or we can't see how they immediately contribute to the bottom line. So how, what's the answer?
Yeah, that's right. And that's where I think that it is this point about focusing in on profitability and not just productivity, not just production. Because farmers, unfortunately, there's still very many, and I think this is very much changing now, but they are stuck in that mentality of production. And if I increase production, I will increase profitability. And so we've been down this pathway. Therefore, to increase production, we spend money. So we are essentially buying yield. We're getting more yield, but we're spending more money to get that more yield. And that's not necessarily increasing profitability. And so the farmers really need to, this will sound too strong, but to forget about yield and focus on profitability. But that is true, because in order to calculate profitability, you have to know your yield. You have to know production. So by default, if you focus on profitability, you are including the yield.
But you can work out and focus on production, and you can work out your yield without knowing what is the profitability of that. I think that that's the important point. I think that in this discussion about soil health transitions or more earthworms or all of this kind of stuff, in many instances, it may not be increasing yield. We might be maintaining yield. It is theoretically possible. We could also potentially even have a lower yield. But if your costs of production are also much lower, if you're saving money on inputs, if you're saving money on labor, et cetera, then your overall profitability can be increasing, even though your yields might be being maintained, for example. So yield is not the driver. It is that profitability that I think more farmers definitely really need to be focused on. And it's really easy if you boil it down to this simple question, like, if I gave you the choice to increase your profitability or increase your production, what would you choose? And when we frame it that way, it's really obvious. We all want to increase profitability. So focus on that, because that is what's going to help you be more productive, because you can't be productive if you're not profitable. You've got to be profitable first, absolutely. So therefore, focus on that. And all of this kind of discussion about, you know, feeding the world and we need to increase more and produce more and all of that kind of whole narrative, yes, that's a really important discussion to be having. But the reality is, if you're not profitable first, then you're not going to feed the world.
Yeah, I think that's right. And really, I think it's all about each one of us as a farmer looking at our farm and looking at what parts of the systems, what role they play and how they can impact the whole system. An example from our farm at home is we changed our drill points to reduce draft and reduce soil disturbance. So, and actually what that meant is that we've gone from about, I think, 15 litres a hectare of diesel to 9 litres a hectare of diesel. That's 40% savings straight away just on that one operation of drilling. And then what we then looked at it a little bit more, and the other thing that enabled us to do is direct drill, and that enabled us to put cover crops in at a time where actually we wouldn't have been able to do it because we couldn't do other operations. It meant that our sheep enterprise benefited. And so you go from changing a small thing like a points on your drill, and suddenly your sheep enterprise is benefiting. And I think that's the beauty of looking at the whole system and just all these little effects and how they can multiply.
Absolutely. And I think another example then of that is looking at profitability across the rotation rather than just per annum. And we're all very guilty of this. We all have to fill out our tax returns on an annual basis, you know, and that grooms us into this annual thinking, and therefore we try to always do things in an annual basis, and that's not the best way to go. So thinking about profitability across the rotation, it's okay to make less money for that field in some of those years, because you can then make more money in the other years, and this can overall even out but add to the, again, the resilience of that system that keeps it to be more sustainable, that you can keep that rather than the concerns that we have with soil degradation, soil loss, erosion, where you are literally undermining your ability to maintain that production and profit by degrading the very resource that those are dependent on.
And I guess another thing to bring in is the ecosystem services the farms can generate, and that viewing that as a diversification perhaps is quite interesting. Like, you know, there's all, I mean, it's this carbon, but there's also public money for public goods. There's potential product marketing. I think there's infinite possibilities. So when farmers ask, you know, will I make my money by doing this? I think the answer is that the potential is absolutely there.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, as you say, even with all of this emerging ecosystem services kind of discussions, of course, there's a lot of opportunity out there. And that's a very emerging new thing. And there's a lot to say there about how we're going to navigate some of the complexities of that too. But nonetheless, there's a great opportunity. At least it's at the table. There's some great discussions happening. And you've got, you know, other premiums kind of involved with a pasture-fed product, for example, or something that's grown a bit more with these ecological type principles. So I think that there's potentials there for some of those kind of premium products to add. to add premiums to what we produce. For me, it's the obvious point is that the premium can come. I hear many farmers saying, well, yeah, what's the good of me doing all this practice if I'm not going to get paid a premium? I often hear this as pushback. But the obvious point is that the premium is the cost savings. It's the lower cost of production. That is, you don't necessarily even need a premium to do all of this because you're going to improve your nutrient use efficiencies. You're going to be less dependent. You're going to save on input costs. That is the premium that you can earn by just simply saving money. But sure, if there's premiums out there too on top of that, great, like cherry on the cake. But otherwise, it's about cost savings.
And I guess final point to that would be that just simply the resilience and actually being able to continue to farm in these difficult conditions and smoothing out the peaks and the troughs. I mean, that's a big one. And for me also, the mental health and the wider societal benefits of the system.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's these peaks and troughs that you mentioned, that really plugs into that point about mental health. You know, it's stressful. There's a lot of anxiety that is comes with having these. Yeah, it's great to have the good years, but then when you have these poor years and the difficult years, it's great to have the high highs, but that also makes harder with the low lows. And that can definitely affect people's mental health, I think. And I think that resilience that you speak in terms of, yeah, you might not get that high high, but you're not going to get that low low either. And it is going to more even out. And I think that evening out, that resilience that you're talking about and that evening out, it makes farming a bit more fun. And a bit more enjoyable. It's stressful otherwise. Having such extremes like this, extremes of weather, extremes of economics, extremes of production, this adds just a whole lot of stress. And that stress is not good for anybody and makes nobody happy at all. So I think it's that being careful of that mindset of being so overly focused on yield and pushing yield. Of course, we all need to eat. Of course, yield is important. But actually just stepping a bit back from that and thinking about the profitability side of things and then doing that in a more, as you say, resilient and sustainable way, I think is also going to make farming more fun, more enjoyable, and it's going to have that better work-life balance that I think a lot of farmers don't have.
Kind of final question really is around future research. And I think we already talked about how, you know, some of the science is perhaps lacking. Maybe we need more research. Maybe we need more on farm trials. You mentioned that kind of farm-to-farm peer-to-peer learning is really, really important. In your view, what are the top, I don't know, 3, 5, 10, 11, 12 research questions HGB should be looking to answer in the next few years?
Obviously nitrogen, I think, is just such a hot issue at the moment. So anything kind of nitrogen related, and there's various kind of things we could pick apart there. Many of your listeners would know that I'm a keen enthusiast on things like foliar nitrogen as a strategy to apply less nitrogen to the soil, because when we apply it to the soil, it's so much more leaky and reactive. This is where the losses of nitrogen occur, is primarily from the soil, be that leaching or off-gassing. So when we foliar apply, we can bypass that soil and bypass those potential losses. So I think there's already great examples, good evidence and good practice of foliar nitrogen being a great tool in the toolbox. But of course, like all things, I'm sure there's a bit of fine tuning and improvement that we could get in a specific UK context. And I think a little bit plugging into that is the contribution of these organic forms of nitrogen that we talked about, amino acids, and how can we use things like foliar synthetic nitrogen combined with amino acids or some of these organic forms for more and greater benefit to get that efficiency gain of those organic forms. So I think kind of, yeah, expanding more on that whole kind of discussion would be really useful and very topical at this point in time. And of course, then we've also got the discussion about some of the nitrogen inhibitors. And of course, now these are being legislated for them to be used. And, you know, I have some mixed views on these. I'm not necessarily totally opposed to them, but I think that there are maybe some hidden consequences to these that maybe does need a bit more fine-tuned looking at. Look, they definitely do what they say on the tin. They definitely help to reduce the losses. And I think that's all good. We definitely need to be reducing nitrogen losses into the ecosystem. This is absolutely needed for sure. But there are some kind of concerns. Just as one small example, the urease inhibitor. The plants themselves also use that same enzyme, that urease enzyme, to make use of urea. So the plant uses urease enzyme to break apart that urea molecule and access that nitrogen and turn it into amino acids and proteins, as we kind of discussed earlier. And so we do have the evidence that shows that those urease inhibitors can be absorbed by plants, and inside the plant, that same urease inhibitor that is designed to block urease enzyme in the soil can also block the exact same enzyme inside the plant, leading to urea buildup in the plant and potential urea toxicities. So I think we have, again, in the literature, good examples of this occurring. So maybe just fine-tuning, maybe if the how big of a concern that is, and if is there some negatives to the use of these materials?
I know there, I suppose, Laura and I, we were talking about clovers as understories or within diverse wards. What sort of questions around that we picked up earlier?
I think there were quite a few questions in terms of sort of that, the nitrogen sort of leaching, I think, quite often. There's a huge push in this country for growing proteins and things like lucerne and red clover for homegrown forage. But obviously there is going to be that sort of increased risk of that nitrogen being lost over that winter period, Joel. Mm. Have you got any sort of thoughts on this in terms of how we can make sure that we are growing and using these legumes within the farming landscape without obviously adding to any environmental issues?
Mm. Yeah, I shared in the lecture series, I shared a great study that was looking at mixtures of legumes with brassicas, these kind of bispecific or companions of combining those two. And many of you, the listeners, may know that brassicas are well-reported, well-renowned nitrate accumulators. They're very good at sucking up nitrates. They really do help to reduce nitrate leaching in the wetter winter months. And there was a great study that I shared, which actually compared a monoculture of brassica with a mixture of brassica with a legume. And they showed that actually that these two treatments captured the exact same amount of nitrates. They performed equally well in terms of sucking up nitrates, even though one was a monoculture brassica, which is the specialist at that role. But then even when we had half the number of those brassicas plus some legumes, we actually achieved the same level of nitrate capture. But having then the mixture there, we got added benefits of green manuring effects. Of course, the legumes were also bringing more nitrogen in, so there was a greater green manuring effect for the then subsequent crop in the rotation. So I think from back to your question there, the obvious answer, thinking about that in reverse, is just that, well, where we are growing maybe lucerne or clovers, etc., rather than grow them as monocultures, can we just put some other companions in there with them to also capture and suck up some of those nitrates that might be leaching then through the winter months? So so could we maybe put some brassicas, for example, with those clovers, for example? Or there could be other species that we could also use. So I would be looking at that. And then I think that the other question that kind of popped up a lot through this series was about the buildup of disease. So legume-based companions, be that as an intercrop or be that the clover understories that you mentioned there as companions. This is a great strategy. I really support it. Again, I know it has some practical challenges, so I think that's something that AHDB could look at. You know, clovers, they'll struggle to thrive in a very dry year, but they'll absolutely take over in a wet year. And so just trying to manage some of that kind of competition effects there, I think would be something to look at. But also whether or not these start to build up disease. We had a lot of this question of, well, if I start including more legume companions or a legume understory, clover understory, when I then put a legume cash crop into the rotation, have I created a green bridge? Have I built up disease for then the legume cash crop? So this is a good question. And I think that that's probably an area that we also need to maybe look at some of the legume diseases that do overlap across the various, because there's some that do and don't, but maybe looking at whether there's a concern of disease buildup with some of these legume companions or legume clover understories, or whether because they're in a companion setting, that again, there may be more of a diversity effect there that helps to prevent kind of the disease buildup so much. So I think that's an area that I would kind of, look into optimizing the role of legume-based companions and making sure that we also maintain the health and the function of those legumes whilst plants are providing that companion role.
No, thank you. I think it really brings back that message, obviously, when you were saying about diversity and actually making sure that we aren't growing those monocultures and relying on that companion relationship can have a huge benefit.
Yeah, that's right. And it's part of that point that when you have a bit more diversity, you know, you have more different hosts there. So there's mechanisms by which you're breaking up the disease pressure and all the disease spread, that type of thing. So it might well be that under those more diverse systems that those legume diseases and things just maybe don't build up so much. Or again, there could be an interaction effect. So because of having the legume with the cereal, that there's some kind of an interaction. This is what systems thinking would tell us. Is there an emergent property there by looking at the interaction between those thereby, just as an example, it might stimulate and encourage a particular group of microbes. This is just an example that then might have very suppressive effects on that pathogen. Or, you know, might the interaction of the two might stimulate certain predators who then will eat those pathogen spores and keep those pathogens depressed under an economic threshold. So there may be an interaction effect that creates an emergent mechanism by which the disease is controlled and therefore it does not build up. And the example of that, of course, if we just think about diverse pastures, permanent pastures, you know, there's cereal, let's just use the example of clover grass. You know, why does that clover not succumb to disease in year five? Why does the grass not succumb to disease in year five? It's permanent, it's perennial, it's been there for many, many years. Why are those diseases not building up and undermining the health of even something like a grass clover lay, for example? So, again, it's that diversity effect that changes things and therefore potentially could yield us some interesting mechanism by which the disease isn't as big of a concern as what we might think it to be. But that definitely needs researching. Yeah, for sure. That's on you folks.
And that's where our chat with plant and soil health expert Joel Williams ends. I'm Laura Audrey, one of the Knowledge Exchange Managers for AHDB Dairy, along with Anna Reynolds, Head of Engagement for Cereals and Oilseeds. I hope you've come away with some useful information. Remember, this is the second and final episode with Joel Williams, so if you missed part one, then please do take a listen to that as well. Over the course of the two parts, we've heard Joel talk about systems approaches, measurement of soil and plant health, nutrition, diversity, and productivity versus profitability, as well as future areas for AHDB to look into for research. Until next time, thanks for listening to the AHDB Food and Farming Podcast.
If you have any comments about this podcast or have ideas for future episodes, please email foodandfarming@ahdb.org.uk.